what I'm talking about yet, but I'm gonna tell you soon. It's a pity. Isn't it a pity? Isn't it a shame? Yes, how we break each other's hearts and cause each other pain. How we take each other's love without thinking anymore. Forgetting to give back, forgetting to remember, just forgetting a note of thank you. Isn't it a pity? Some things take so long. But how do I explain when not too many people can see that we all just the same? We're all guilty because of all our tears. Our eyes just can't hope to see, though I don't think it's applicable to me, the beauty that surrounds them. Child, isn't it a pity? How we break each other's hearts and cause each other pain. How we take each other's love, the most precious thing, without thinking anymore. Forgetting to give back, forgetting to keep open our door. Isn't it a pity? Isn't it a pity? Some things take so long, but how do I explain? Isn't it a pity when not too many people surrounds them? Maybe that's why we cry. God, it's pity. Lord knows it's a pity. Mankind has been so programmed. They don't care about nothing that has to do with care. C-A-R-E. How we take each other's love, most precious thing.
Nina Simone, beginning our program today with one of my all-time favorites by her, Isn't It a Pity, which appears on her 1972 album, emergency ward, a protest against the Vietnam War. The song originally was written by Beatle George Harrison in 1966 and appears on his 1970 album, All Things Must Pass. And it is so applicable today to our program. For today, we remember Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. And today, many years ago, 48 years ago, the nation was, and the world, were gripped with the harsh reality that he had been cut down in Memphis, Tennessee, at the Lorraine Motel, on the balcony of the Lorraine Motel, where he had gone to organize support for African-American sanitation workers who were on strike for equal pay and better working conditions. He was 39 years old. Well, of course, we don't recognize the enormity of his contribution very often, and we tend to, you know, put it together with other milestones, such as his birthday and the actual day of the assassination, which was yesterday. But I thought I would talk about him today in the same way that the nation this day in 1968 was dealing with the enormity of the moment. On May the 17th in 1957, Dr. King was just barely out of his 20s when he addressed a group in Washington, D.C., at the burgeoning phase of the modern civil rights movement. This group had gone to Washington, D.C. to urge congressional action on a slate of laws to end racial segregation and assure equal rights for all citizens, but in specific to African Americans who had been under the yoke of direct oppression for so long. This march was called the Prayer Pilgrimage for Freedom. It drew demonstrators largely from churches and religious groups, but it also drew people who were sympathetic to the cause, and it was an early indication not only of the pivotal role King would play in the galvanizing of support and momentum for this movement, but also in challenging the power structure's resistance to the movement's demands. As you know, Dr. King at that time was also fresh out of school, learning the ropes as a young preacher, but applying almost immediately the grand tradition of the pastorship, the role of the pastor. It was, in effect, liberation theology. So his speech, which we are about to hear, is rooted in that tradition, and he brings to bear the admonitions of the Christian church to a crowd ready to receive the word, as it were. So we have to appreciate the speech in that context. It doesn't mean to offend anyone or anyone's particular religious belief, but we appreciate, and I make a note of it, to appreciate the context of the speech. Bear in mind, he's a young man. And already you can hear the divine hand on him, for the content of the speech was quite prophetic. In the speech, because we have to always link things, you know, we've been talking here about political leadership and calling things out. And here in this moment, in 1957, this young preacher began to do just that. And as we listen to this speech, I want you to pay particular attention to what he says about sellout leadership, about the treachery of liberals, and about the integrity of the vote. Why is this important? Because only yesterday I was talking about the obscenity of preachers defiling their sanctuaries with the crass business of politics. And politics that had no interest at all and no benefit to the people. Just show up, do a stereotypical act, and then make off with the vote, which was hard won. And the reason I bring this to your attention today also is this is the day in 1968 that the enormity of the loss of this life was felt not only in the United States, but all around the world. And we honor it today by returning to his words and to his admonitions. Here is Dr. Martin Luther King on May the 17th, 1957, addressing demonstrators who had gathered in Washington, D.C. for a prayer pilgrimage for freedom.
Mr. Chairman, distinguished platform associates, fellow Americans, three years ago, the Supreme Court of this nation rendered in simple, eloquent, and unequivocal language a decision which will long be stenciled on the mental sheets of succeeding generations. For all men of goodwill, this May 17th decision came as a joyous daybreak to end the long night of human captivity. It came as a great beacon light of hope to millions of disinherited people throughout the world who had dared only to dream of freedom. Unfortunately, this noble and sublime decision has not gone without opposition. This opposition has often risen to ominous proportions. Many states have risen up in open defiance. The legislative halls of the South ring loud with such words as interposition and nullification. But even more, all types of conniving methods are still being used to prevent Negroes from becoming registered voters. The denial of this sacred right is a tragic betrayal of the highest mandates of our democratic tradition. So our most urgent request to the President of the United States and every member of Congress is to give us the right to vote. Give us the ballot, and we will no longer have to worry the federal government about our basic rights. Give us the ballot, and we will no longer plead to the federal government for passage of an anti-lynching law. We will, by the power of our vote, write the law on the statute books of the South and bring an end to the dastardly acts of the hooded perpetrators of violence. Give us the ballot, and we will transform the salient misdeeds of bloodthirsty mobs into the calculated good deeds of orderly citizens. Give us the ballot, and we will fill our legislative halls with men of goodwill and send to the sacred halls of Congress men who will not sign a Southern manifesto because of their devotion to the manifesto of justice. Give us the ballot, and we will place judges on the benches of the South who will do justly and love mercy. And we will place at the head of the Southern states governors who have felt not only the tang of the human, but the glow of the divine. Give us the ballot, and we will quietly and nonviolently, without rancor or bitterness, implement the Supreme Court's decision of May 17, 1954. In this juncture of our nation's history, there is an urgent need for dedicated and courageous leadership. If we are to solve the problems ahead and make racial justice a reality, this leadership must be fourfold. First, there is need for strong, aggressive leadership from the federal government. So far, only the judicial branch of the government has evinced this quality of leadership. If the executive and legislative branches of the government were as concerned about the protection of our citizenship rights as the federal courts have been, then the transition from a segregated to an integrated society would be infinitely smoother. But we so often look to Washington in vain for this concern. In the midst of the tragic breakdown of law and order, the executive branch of the government is all too silent and apathetic. In the midst of the desperate need for civil rights legislation, the legislative branch of the government is all too stagnant and hypocritical. This dearth of positive leadership from the federal government is not confined to one particular political party. Both political parties have betrayed the cause of justice. The Democrats have betrayed it by capitulating to the prejudices and undemocratic practices of the Southern Dixiecrats. The Republicans have betrayed it by capitulating to the blatant hypocrisy of right-wing reactionary Northerners. These men so often have a high blood pressure of words and an anemia of deeds. In the midst of these prevailing conditions, we come to Washington today pleading with the President and members of Congress to provide a strong moral and courageous leadership for a situation that cannot permanently be evaded, we come humbly to say to the men in the forefront of our government that the civil rights issue is not an ephemeral, evanescent domestic issue that can be kicked about by reactionary guardians of the status quo. It is rather an eternal moral issue, which may well determine the destiny of our nation in the ideological struggle with communism. The hour is late. The clock of destiny is ticking out. We must act now before it is too late. A second area in which there is need for strong leadership is from the white northern liberals. That is a dire need today for liberalism which is truly liberal. What we are witnessing today in so many northern communities is a sort of quasi-liberalism which is based on the principle of looking sympathetically at all sides. It is a liberalism so bent on seeing all sides that it fails to become committed to either side. It is a liberalism that is so objectively analytical that it is not subjectively committed. It is a liberalism which is neither hot nor cold, but lukewarm. We call for a liberalism from the North which will be thoroughly committed to the ideal of racial justice and will not be deterred by the propaganda and subtle words of those who say, slow up for a while, you're pushing too fast. A third source that we must look to for strong leadership is from the moderates of the white South. It is unfortunate that at this time the leadership of the white South stems from the close-minded reactionaries. These persons gain prominence and power by the dissemination of false ideas and by deliberately appealing to the deepest hate responses within the human mind. It is my firm belief that this close-minded, reactionary, recalcitrant group constitutes a numerical minority. There are in the white South more open-minded moderates than appears on the surface. These persons are silent today because of fear of social, political, and economic reprisals. God grant that the white moderates of the South will rise up courageously, without fear, and take up the leadership in this tense period of transition. I cannot close without stressing the urgent need for strong, courageous and intelligent leadership from the Negro community. We need a leadership that is calm and yet positive. This is no day for the rabble-rouser, whether he be Negro or white. We must realize that we are grappling with the most weighty social problem of this nation. And in grappling with such a complex problem, that is no place for misguided emotionalism. We must work passionately and unrelentingly for the goal of freedom. But we must be sure that our hands are clean in the struggle. We must never struggle with falsehood, hate, or malice. We must never become bitter. I know how we feel sometimes. That is the danger that those of us who have been forced so long to stand amid the tragic midnight of oppression, those of us who have been trampled over, those of us who have been kicked about, that is the danger that we will become bitter. But if we will become bitter, and indulge in hate campaigns. Though the new order which is emerging will be nothing but a duplication of the old order. We must meet hate with love. We must meet physical force with soul force. That is still a voice crying out through the vista of time, saying, love your enemies. Bless them that curse you. Pray for them that despitefully use you. Then and only then can you matriculate into the university of eternal life. That same voice cries out in turns lifted to cosmic proportions, he who lives by the sword will perish by the sword. History is replete with the bleached bones of nations that failed to follow this command. We must follow nonviolence and love. Now, I'm not talking about a sentimental, shallow kind of love. I'm not talking about eros, which is a sort of aesthetic, romantic love. I'm not even talking about philia, which is a sort of intimate affection between personal friends. But I'm talking about agape. I'm talking about the love of God in the hearts of men. I'm talking about a type of love which will cause you to love the person who does the evil deed while hating the deed that the person does. We've got to love. That is another warning signal. We talk a great deal about our rights, and rightly so. We proudly proclaim that three-fourths of the peoples of the world are colored. We have the privilege of noticing in our generation the great drama of freedom and independence as it unfolds in Asia and Africa. All of these things are in line with the unfolding work of providence, but we must be sure that we accept them in the right spirit. We must not seek to use our emerging freedom and our growing power to do the same thing to the white minority that has been done to us for so many centuries. Our aim must never be to defeat or humiliate the white man. We must not become victimized with a philosophy of black supremacy. God is not interested merely in freeing black men and brown men and yellow men, but God is interested in freeing the whole human race. We must work with determination to create a society, not where black men are superior and other men are inferior and vice versa, but a society in which all men will live together as brothers and respect the dignity and worth of human personality. We must also avoid the temptation of being victimized with the psychology of victors. We have won marvelous victories. And through the work of the NAACP, we have been able to do some of the most amazing things of this generation. And I come this afternoon with nothing but praise for this great organization, the work that it has already done and the work that it will do in the future. And although they outlawed in Alabama and other states, the fact still remains that this organization has done more to achieve civil rights for Negroes than any other organization we can point to. And certainly this is fine. But we must not, however, remain satisfied with a court victory over our white brothers. We must respond to every decision with an understanding of those who have opposed us, and with an appreciation of the difficult adjustments that the court orders pose for them, we must act in such a way as to make possible a coming together of white people and colored people on the basis of a real harmony of interests and understanding. We must seek an integration based on mutual respect. I conclude by saying that each of us must keep faith in the future. Let us not despair. Let us realize that as we struggle for justice and freedom, we have cosmic companionship. This is the long faith of the Hebraic Christian tradition, that God is not some Aristotelian unmoved mover who merely contemplates upon himself. He's not merely a self-knowing God, but an ever-loving God, forever working through history for the establishment of his kingdom. And those of us who call the name of Jesus Christ find something of an event in our Christian faith that tells us this. That is something in our faith that says to us, never despair, never give up, never feel that the cause of righteousness and justice is doomed. That is something in our Christian faith at the center of it, which says to us that Good Friday may occupy the throne for a day, but ultimately it must give way to the triumphant beat of the drums of Easter. That is something in our faith that says evil may so shape events that Caesar will occupy the palace and Christ a cross. But one day that same Christ will rise up and split history into A.D. and B.C. so that even the life of Caesar must be dated by his name. That is something in this universe which justifies Carlyle in saying no lie can live forever. That is something in this universe which justifies William Cullen Bryant in saying, truth crushed to earth will rise again. That is something in this universe which justifies James Russell Lowell in saying, truth forever on the scaffold, wrong forever on the throne. Yet that scaffold sways the future, and behind the dim unknown stands God within the shadow, keeping watch above his own. Go out with that faith today. Go back to your homes in the Southland with that faith today. Go back to Philadelphia, to New York, to Detroit and Chicago with that faith today. The universe is on our side in the struggle. Stand up for justice. Sometimes it gets hard, but it is always difficult to get out of Egypt. The Red Sea always stands before you with discouraging dimensions. And even after you cross the Red Sea, you have to move through a wilderness with prodigious hilltops of evil and gigantic mountains of opposition. But I say to you this afternoon, keep moving. Let nothing slow you up. Move on with dignity and honor and respectability. I realize that it will cause restless nights sometimes. It might cause losing a job. It will cause suffering and sacrifice. It might even cause physical death for some. But if physical death is the price that some must pay to free their children from a permanent life of psychological death, then nothing can be more Christian. Keep going today. Keep moving amid every obstacle. Yes, keep moving amid every mounting of opposition. Yes, and if you will do that with dignity, when the history books are written in the future, the historians will have to look back and say, there lived a great people. Yes, a people with fleecy locks and black complexion. But a people who injected new meaning into the veins of civilization. A people which stood up with dignity and honor and saved Western civilization in her darkest hour. A people that gave new integrity and a new dimension of love to our civilization. And when that happens, the morning stars will sing together and the sons of God will shout for joy.
We take each other's love, the most precious thing, without thinking anymore. keep open the door. But I understand some things take so long. How do I explain? Why not too many people can see we're just the same? And because of all their tears, their eyes can't hope to see the beauty that surrounds them. Isn't it a pity? The beauty that surrounds them. It's a pity. We take each other's love.
You're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. I'm Eutrice Lead, and we just heard from Dr. Martin Luther King speaking on May the 17th, 1957, speaking to a group gathered there in Washington titled The Prayer Pilgrimage for Freedom, and speaking rather prophetically about a range of things, and without reiterating them, I in fact would like to ask you, what resonated with you in that speech, taking into account all the things that we've been discussing so far, and also being specific about what the content of the speech was? How does that relate to where we are today and the work to be done and the admonition that you believe that Dr. King had given us all the way back then in 1957? 888-874-4888. There was a lot said there that should have immediately come to mind, given our current situation, our current circumstances, and certainly in the current political season. Is it interesting that people with vision always seem to be able to be current, no matter whenever they issued that vision or had a chance to share that vision? They always seem to kind of be able to see how we would be living and what we would be dealing with so many years after they have gone from this earth. I prefer to deal with this today, this aspect today of Dr. King, his wonderful life. And you heard him basically predict or accept that struggle can be very costly, even, as he said, a physical death, which came for him on April the 4th, 1968. Your thoughts about the message of Dr. King as it applies to our realities today. What do you think he was trying to tell us? What do you think we have ignored from what it is he was trying to tell us? What was the message, and what still remains to be the work to be done? We talk all the time in reverential terms about people and heroes and so forth, and we act sometimes like we never did have a point of reference. We never were given counsel. We never did have the benefit of visions. We never did have a roadmap. We have no point of reference for how we are to navigate, that we always have to start from scratch. And yet, in that speech, I'm sure you must have heard all kinds of indications that it is we who are falling short, because these things have been mapped out for us. We've been told, we've been warned, we've been schooled, we've been educated. What, therefore, is the problem? Why are we, in 2016, still not yet familiar with this, with these maps and these incredible admonitions that have been given us? From Baltimore, Marie, you're on the air.
Good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call.
Thank you for calling.
I think that Dr. Martin King was trying to say, keep on pushing on, even though it may be hard. And also, it applies to today, because it will be even harder today than when King was alive, seriously. And what King has said back then, there's others saying it today, that there may be bloodshed. That's what I hear today. And I did like your show on Hillary yesterday. Thank you very much. That's all I have to say.
Thank you so much. Before you go, though, I want to know why that stood out for you more than anything else.
You mean in his speech about,
yes,
keep on pushing on?
The message. Why did that resonate with you? Why did that in particular resonate with you?
I think, like I said before, it means to keep on pushing on for justice.
Mm-hmm.
Because what we have running for our candidates, I agree with you that I don't care for any of them.
I can't seem to relate.
Excuse me?
Thank you for your call. Thanks so much for getting us started today. Ali from New York, what do you think?
Hi, Utrecht. How are you doing?
Thank you.
Okay, one thing that it resonates from that speech is when he talks about that if people get the chance, you will be able to push on and move on and get to those places where right now there is a lot of people of color, and he talks about judges. We will put people in those judgeship, and they will do well, people of moral. And if he sees what's happening right now, look at Clarence Thomas, what that man has done for people of color. Look in New York City, these politicians. They don't want to sacrifice themselves. And that's what he talks about at the end. We have to be able, some of us will have to put our life on the line and sacrifice ourselves for others. And if you take a look at this politician, this city council in this city, what they just have done, they just approve a rezoning of some areas in here in the city where people of color will be pushed out and one group will move in and people don't know what to do. And who do we have in the city council? The majority of people of color, Latinos and African-American. And these are the people that they're not willing to sacrifice themselves because it's about greed and it's about money. And that is one message that he said. We need to sacrifice ourselves. If some of us don't sacrifice ourselves for others, we're not going to get anywhere. because this is what is happening right now. Even with this election, take a look at these Latinos and this African American, especially African American, how they go and they want to vote for this woman. This woman that her husband and her has done so much damage to black people. Haiti, Libya, I mean, you go on. Stop, you know, the mass incarceration in this country and goes on and on and on. And, you know, everything is about greed and about money. Thank you.
Thank you for your call. Jose from Rosedale, you're on the air.
I, as always, may the ancestral ancestors continue to bless you always.
Thank you.
You know, I just heard your last sentence. I'm not up on the program, but I'm going to say my little piece. For I gather from what you're saying, you're dealing with Dr. King's speech, which it might have been a speech I heard before. But anyway, I think what Dr. King was trying to impart in us is a kind of selflessness, a kind of courage around our condition, not only in this country, but in this world, which reminds me of something that Mr. Garvey said. This is something that was instilled in Dr. King. And you'll only find it in certain kind of leadership. And Mr. Garvey says, and I quote, in 1924, he said, "I was fully aware of all the cost before I entered service for the Universal Negro Improvement Association." He said, "The cost is ingratitude. The cost is persecution. The cost is death. And those who have led great movements counted the cost and were prepared for the extreme of it." Unquote. My prof, we as a people, we have reached a point in our life where we don't see anything worth fighting and dying for. Freedom is not free. The cost of freedom is very expensive, and Dr. King proved it. Marcus Garvey, Malcolm, all those leaders that we have had has proven to us that if we don't struggle, if we don't have that courage in us to stand up for our beliefs and fight for what we believe in, what is right and just for us, we are not going to make an advancement in this world. This afternoon, I'm going to a forum in the city by the New York City Bar Association. And it's going to be about decolonizing of education in South Africa. On the African continent, in this stage of our development, or one would say underdevelopment, we are just talking about the decolonizing the education system in South Africa. And I want to find out from them when they're going to have a conference here about the decolonizing of the education system in the United States. And so, my prof, this is where we are as a people. If we are not prepared to stand up and make the ultimate sacrifices to gain our freedom, we can cast our lot with the political system. We can cast our lot with the charlatan that the Black Congressional Caucus and the pastors and some of these community activists, all these charlatans that are there, are as interlocutors between us and our enemies. We're not going to get anywhere. We have to be prepared to fight. And that ultimate fight is what most of us are afraid of standing up for. Because we can't sing ourselves to freedom. We can't dance our way to freedom. And we cannot pray our way to freedom. We're going to have to fight on all fronts to free not only our physical body, but our minds. And I thank you, as always, for the great work you're doing in trying to help us to regain, some of us to regain our minds, because most of us have lost our minds. And as I've said, if any black man, woman, and child living in this country don't transcribe to a conspiracy theory that the enemy is out to get us, then they are stark, staring mad and out of their mind. Thank you, my prof.
Thank you so much for calling. From Philadelphia, Claire, you're on the air. Hello, you're on the air.
Hillary, can you hear me?
Yes.
Hello? Okay. I want to thank you for your talk yesterday about the Hillary situation. I've sent it all out to as many people as I can think of, hoping to change their minds. I'm talking about black women who want to vote for her because she is a woman. But anyway, I also want to thank you for the song. Nina Simone is one of my favorites. But I listened to the speech today that you played. Actually, he was 26, because I know that because in 57, I was 23. Okay, so he was, I know that he was 26, I think, maybe you were right, but he was young. As you said, one of the things that we don't talk about, and it's very difficult to talk about, is what I see as, to a large extent, in many people in the community, is self-loathing. It's hard to fight for your life, even, if you don't love yourself. Some of this absence of the need to love the self is seen, I think, in the church. I like what Dr. King said about loving others, but if we don't love ourselves first, really, really love ourselves, it's not going to work. We can't love anyone else. I want to give you an example of what I'm talking about. When I was in college, I took a course in the history of religion, and I took it from, at that time, we had world-renowned people in the classrooms. They weren't just out there writing books. And so my professor asked the question one day, what is the basic thesis of Christianity? And I was the only person who answered. I happened to have read that part of the Bible the night before in preparation for the coming exam. I said, love thy neighbor as thyself. And she said, no, that would be too selfish. I said nothing further. Other people made suggestions, and I didn't even hear them, because that's what I do in my mind. I just dismiss the whole situation, go home, bring the Bible back to the next class, and showed it to her. She was amazed. It seemed to be buried somehow in Christianity. And it's, well, how you start is exquisitely taking care of yourself. And I know I sound like a broken record. But I do believe what the Bible says. I'm sure it's in there. I didn't read it, but I've heard other people say it. The body is the temple of the soul. Start there, and it takes you so many places, within and without. That's all I have to say today. And thank you so much.
Well, thank you. And that brings us to the end of our program today. You know, it's always, to me, quite a revelation when people who we respect literally define themselves by what they say in speeches. They tell you in so many ways what is at the core of them, what makes them tick. They tell you, in some cases, and we've been very, very fortunate, all of us have been very fortunate to have people among us who can see things, can see a way, and more importantly, can point us to that way. The unfortunate thing is, we are not ready sometimes to receive what they have to offer, nor are we in some cases willing to receive what they have to offer. And in other cases, we take for granted what they have to offer. But in any event, we ignore the purpose of their offering, which is to help us go a better way, find a better life, and to warn us about the signs that we ought to pay attention to let us know that we are on the wrong path. There was so much in this speech having to do with the kind of leadership that we ought to demand and support, the possibilities that we have at hand if only we have a leadership that we choose, we connect with, we support. And the flip side of that coin, what could happen, of course, when that leadership simply isn't there, that quality of leadership just isn't there? All these ideals that could have been realized within our lifetime, and certainly even within his own, completely railroaded in some cases by compromised leadership, by people who have entirely different agendas, by people who are not at all committed to the idea that everyone deserves to be free, everyone deserves the benefit of equality. And this is why we should honor the memory, and we should honor Dr. King and others like him, so many others like him who had been among us and had given us a template by which to live our lives. Thank you for joining me today. It's a pleasure always and a great privilege to be in your company. Bye-bye.
Things take so long, and I cannot explain.